Welcome to the Back to This Podcast, show number 12. My name is Gabriel. Welcome to everybody, especially if you are new to this podcast. Tim and Cindy Travis left the comforts of normal life and went around the world traveling by bike and, to quote them, with no plans to stop. If it is the first time you hear from them, then I urge you to go back to the special presentation titled The Road That Has No End and listen to the chapter number 1 of their audiobook. At this moment, they are in Canberra, Australia, and we have them for you in this exclusive podcast interview brought to you by... Back to This Podcast. Hello, Tim, Cindy, how are you?
Hello, how are you?
Hello, Gabriel.
Yeah, for me it's an honor to have you here. You know, I've been looking forward for this interview for a long time, and now we finally have it. It's finally a reality. So how are you? Tell us, how are you today?
Well, we're fine. We're in Canberra, Australia, and it's been raining the last couple of days, and we're heading north up towards Brisbane in the next few months.
That's cool. Okay, I have one question. Now that you are so close to 5 years on the road, what is the first feeling that comes to your mind when you look back? Both of you, I want to hear both of your impressions.
My first impression is no regrets.
Mm-hmm. And Tim?
Yeah,
go on.
Well, we've been looking back at the 5 years a lot. March 30th will be our 5-year anniversary. And we've really changed in how we look at the world and what we think about travel in general. And we've matured and grown up on this trip. We can look back at pictures of us 5 years ago, and we even look younger when we started.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How was your adaptation from normal life to this, let me use the word, nomadic lifestyle? How was your adaptation from the normal life? Tell us about it.
Well, the first 2 years was really when we adopted to travel. Before that, we were still learning. And it just took a lot of forgetting the old way we lived with a house and regular internet connection and TV and air conditioner and all these things to being kind of homeless and floating around the globe. What do you think, Cindy?
It really changed for me when we were in Asia after our first 2 years, and I stopped thinking of the trip as we're traveling, this is a trip, and more like this is how I live now, and I tended to slow down my pace a lot more and didn't feel like I had to go out and do everything.
I guess that sums it up. It has become our new lifestyle, and the way it was before was just a previous phase of our life. We're no longer on a trip. We're just doing our daily thing.
Yeah. And in that line, has sometimes the comfort of normal life have whispered into your ear from time to time, or you just comfortable with your actual way of life?
Well, sometimes that comfort calls on us and we take a short break, maybe a month or two, but the road, I feel real comfortable on the road, so does Tim. And so when we get tired, we just take a break like we did in Malaysia for a couple months, and then we get back on the road again.
And Tim?
I just have to agree with her that it's just hard to explain that we are no longer on a trip, which is part of our lives. The trip has become our lives. And we just live on a bike nomadically. And when we think of what we've given up to do it, it's more like what you gave up when you were a child or what you gave up when you're in university. It's just a previous phase of our life we can never bring back. It's now we're forever adrift.
Yeah, you know that this is you are different from the all the other people that we have interviewed here in the podcast, because like you said, all of the other people have been on a trip. You know, they had a normal life back where they belong. They went to a bike tour. They get went to a great adventure, visiting places, experiencing people and places and foods and cultures. But in the end, they all had to go back to their regular life. But you are living on the road. You are living on the road. So in this aspect that you are experiencing about back touring, if we can call that back touring, it's different. It's different. Because normally when we say back touring, it's like a trip. But like you said, it's no longer a trip. It's a way of life. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think it is different when you don't have plans to return. Like as we sit here, we don't have a ticket, airplane ticket out of Australia. And when you have more time, when you have a lot of time and there's no end to the trip, you slow down a lot and you just look around more and you have more time, I think, to experience the culture around you. When you got a time to go home, I think you try to hurry up and see as much as you can because it's going to end.
I agree.
Mm-hmm. Okay, talking about your experience that all this time on the road, what are the most important life lessons that you have learned on the road? Take your time, because it's not an easy question when you have to look into your mind, look into your experience, about the life lessons that you learn on the road. Every day you learn a lesson, but there are some that stand out more than others. What do you have to share with us about this?
What comes to mind to me right away is that we're all humans first. You know, when we first started traveling, it was looking at all our differences, that we speak a different language, that we eat different food and we have different customs. But after being on the road for a while and seeing many different cultures, I realized that people really are human first. We all get up in the morning. We all need to eat. Kids are really relatively similar in whatever culture. When they're two, in Australia, they're two in Peru. And so for me, it's like, oh, we're all humans.
I think she's saying that we're all more similar than different. And some of us are bad, most of us are good, and that's true of any country of the world.
Mm. And I believe that when you go to all these countries and you share with all these people, you take something from you, from them, sorry. You take something from them and make it part of your own personality. Is that correct?
You do. You kind of pick up on the aspects of different cultures that you find favorable. It all depends. Kind of a different way of looking at life that everybody has, and the things that I found attractive I picked up on. Another thing that I think that we've learned kind of early on in the trip is that poverty doesn't equal crime. That people thought we would be robbed in, say, Guatemala or Cambodia or, you know, one of the poorer countries of the world. But as it turns out, desperation equals crime. And the poor people aren't necessarily going to rob you. That the certain percentage of people in every country, in every walk of life, are criminal and the rest aren't, so you just got to avoid that percentage. But there's not a higher percentage among poor people. I think it's the same percentage among all people.
What do you have to say about that, Cindy?
I agree. And it kind of reinforces when I first left. These are one thing I thought was, you know, people are good, basically good. And after traveling this long, it's nice to have that feeling that, yes, people, I still believe all people are good, that there's not, you know, they're not out to, most people are out to get to know you, they're curious, they're hospitable, and it's not, you're not always battling pickpockets and robbery and all that.
It goes true with not, it's not that one place is more generous than another, that's all pretty relatively the same too, that people are basically people, and that's hard to get across. It's hard to put in words. You can tell Cindy and I are struggling with this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It took 5 years of living on a bike for us to come to these conclusions, and it's hard to put in words.
Yeah, it's okay. Okay, I have this question especially for Cindy, you know. As we were commenting yesterday when we had the call, you're the first lady to be interviewed here in the podcast. So this is the first one for the Bike Tourist podcast. But I have one question. How hard is it for a woman to adapt to this kind of traveling life?
Well, for me, it wasn't too difficult. I like to travel. My former, I was a geologist in the past, and that kind of prepared me for being outdoors and dealing with all kinds of weather. And I like camping, so that part was easy to, relatively easy to adapt to. And then Tim, the nice thing, we always stay together. If I have too much weight, he'll take it. He's concerned to make sure that I always want to keep going. So it's kind of a mutual thing. If you don't like to camp, I don't think you would like this lifestyle. But I enjoy it a lot.
Okay.
When I miss get out there and ride.
Yeah. When Tim first laid out his idea of traveling the world by bike, did you actually see yourself traveling like that?
Yes and no. I thought it was kind of a dream of his, and I thought, I saw the traveling part. I really didn't see the biking part because I had already traveled, and I liked that aspect. And then I do like to ride my bike, so the putting the two together kind of fell together naturally, and I thought, oh, we could try this. And it really came together when we were on our honeymoon and we were traveling in the Northwest, and we had to end after 3 weeks, and I just wanted to keep going. And then I thought, wow, we could. Maybe we could.
Okay.
And so my interest was peaked then.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, one thing, I don't know if I asked this question before. I have a listing here, I'm scrolling up and down. But what is the most difficult aspect of living on the road?
People ask us this all the time. What was the most difficult part of your trip? And to be honest, it was leaving our front door. All the things it takes to prepare and to completely shift your life from having a career and a car and all these things to living on the road is extremely complicated. After we left the house, so to speak, or after we left on the trip, everything else seemed easy after that. But the biggest accomplishment I still think that we have is just actually throwing all this together and I call it taking a big leap in the dark and not knowing where you're going to land. And it was that big leap, leaving home and leaving on a bicycle, that was the biggest accomplishment.
Do you think that traveling by bike has bring the two of you closer to each other?
Oh, definitely. We started out in Latin America, and Tim kind of didn't let me out of his sight in Latin America, and we stayed real close together. He kind of took care of me. And when you weather storms together and then have really interesting things happen together, and then we get to converse about everything we see all day long. I certainly know Tim a lot better now than I did when we left.
Mm. Okay, so we are going to move a little bit in a little bit different direction now. We are going to I'm going to ask several trip questions. If you want to at any moment to some idea just cross your mind. You can go back to whatever thing is going on in your mind. So this is feel free with this. Okay, I have some trip questions that some people ask me all the time, and this goes for all the shows that we have been brought to people. The first question is, in what countries you felt safer, and in which countries you really were concerned about your personal safety?
Well, the countries we felt the safest in probably thus far would be Australia. Australia is extremely safe, but and then maybe Argentina and Chile and China and Malaysia was quite safe. Not saying the other ones were dangerous, but those are the ones we felt the most safe in, or the safest, I should say. The most dangerous countries are the ones we felt were the least stable or the most unsafe. Not saying that they're so unsafe you shouldn't go. I don't want to talk anybody out of anything here. But there are some places where you feel more comfortable than others. Guatemala and Honduras kind of have an edgy side to them, and you have to keep your wits about you. Ecuador and Peru, certainly we have known many people who've been robbed in these countries, and you just have to keep your wits about you. Cindy?
And Bolivia, but Bolivia was more, it was in a political turmoil, so it felt unstable in the sense that they were blocking roads and things like that. It wasn't like I felt like they were going to rob me at any time. But, you know, one of the things I kind of took for granted is just political stability in my country. And then when you go somewhere else and it's not stable, it certainly put me on edge.
Yeah, it reminds me of, I've said that before in some interviews, when my trip to Venezuela, when we got married, we went to our honeymoon in Caracas. You know, when we got there, we were shocked to see soldiers on the street, you know, strapping guns and machine guns and everywhere. So we said, oh, what's happening here? So I think this kind of feeling is what you feel in Bolivia or these countries. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Asia in general was safer than some of the countries I just mentioned. But when there's more tourists, like in a country like Thailand, the more tourists, the more dangerous it feels a little bit. But like I said, China was very safe, and Asia felt altogether safer.
Okay. One thing, listened to your audiobook, one thing that, you know, at the beginning, it looks like something funny, but when I continue listening, it really was frightening. It was the, you know, tell us about the melon bombs in Guatemala. You know, this was, I think it was the scariest moment. Tell us about it.
Well, yeah, we were just crossed the border. The difference between Mexico and Guatemala is quite striking. Guatemala, especially near the border, is quite poor and quite desperate. And we had just really never seen this before. So we were kind of upset with our surroundings. And then we were going up a very tight canyon, and it was on and off rain, and we had nowhere to stay. And that night, we actually wound up staying in a bus stop. But that's another story. But as we were riding up the canyon from nowhere, maybe 100 meters, 300 feet above us or more, was someone throwing a fruit about the size and weight of a watermelon or a cantaloupe. And it really could have hurt, and we didn't know why they were throwing them or what, but had we been hit by that, we would have probably killed us or hurt us badly at least. And so it was like being bombed from above, and we just sprinted around a corner and got out of the situation, but it really put us on edge. And like I said, that night we wound up sleeping just on the side of the road. But in the morning, all the indigenous people came down from the hills to get on the bus, and we had a nice interchange with them, which is also in the book.
Yeah. Okay. When you select your route in South America, what was your main criteria for selecting the countries you were going to start? You know, I ask this because there are some people that have some concerns about South America, which countries go through, which to avoid. Did you have any of these concerns when you were planning the route on South America?
Well, basically, I plan the route anywhere we go, including South America, around the weather and the wind direction. And I knew that June, July, August was best for the Ecuadorian and Peruvian highlands. And then as we traveled south, it would be summertime in Patagonia towards December. So I planned it around that. We didn't go to Colombia because of the reputation it has with foreigners. Now, I know other cyclists have gone there, and that's fine for them. But we chose not to, and we flew straight to Quito, Ecuador, and pretty much went south along the spine of the Andes until we reached summertime in Patagonia.
You know that we have. I work in a medicine school here in the island, and we have PhDs from all over the world, and we have this doctor who is Russian, and he worked for a long time in Colombia, and he told me that he had a friend that he was a bike tourist, and on his free time he went around the country. In this case, Colombia, they were doing their postdoc over there. And in one of his trips, he was caught by the guerrilla. They thought he was some kind of a spy, and they killed him. So this was terrible news. And he told me that he worked in that country. Let's be clear. You know, many people is listening to this show. And we are not saying that the country is bad, you know. But there are countries where you can have more trouble than other countries, and there are things that are under control, and there are things that simply are not under control. And this is what we're talking here. And for a foreigner, maybe for a local, it's okay, but for a foreigner, but you have to think about where you're going. In this case, you know. This doctor, he could not speak much Spanish, so he could not communicate too well. This cost him his life.
Well, that's very sad to hear. We chose not to go to Colombia. We caught some flack from the website, people telling us that we're cowards or whatnot, that we didn't go to Colombia, but it's just a choice we made. Maybe we could have gone, maybe it would have been fine, but it's no fun to travel when you're afraid. And so we just chose not to go.
Okay, now turning a little on topic. You know, I saw your photographs from South America. You know, these are beautiful photographs. You know, do these photographs make justice to do what you saw with your own eyes? Because I saw these photographs, especially the volcanoes, these big volcanoes, and I said, wow, if this looks like this in just a photograph, how would it be to see with your own eyes? How was that? You know, try to convey in some words. I know it's hard, but try to convey about the beauty that you saw over there.
Well, photograph can never capture what you see with your own eyes. That's true of any place that you travel and take pictures. But it does remind us, South America was by far the most beautiful continent we traveled. And, you know, you could climb a hill for 3 or 4 days in a row, uphill every day, and see smoking volcanoes and snow-capped mountains. And then you could descend for an entire day back down to sea level. And you know, we came close to 5,000 meters, I think 4,600 meters, which it's hard for me to think in feet anymore. And just the beauty and the sheer diversity of South America is hard to explain. I'm glad I have the pictures, but it doesn't really capture what I saw with my eyes.
One of my favorite areas that we have cycled through is Chile and Argentina, and it's quite easy to go back and forth across the border there. Along the Andes, and the Andes get lower and lower as you get farther into Patagonia, and you have glacial topography, and then you have volcanoes, and it is just a stunning place. And Chile and Argentina is a modern countries. You can drink the water, which is really high on the list for me because it means you can eat salads and you don't have to worry about getting sick as much. And I would really highly recommend that area. We traveled with a woman that was single, traveling alone, and she had no problem. So I want to make sure that our impression of South America isn't, you know, you just have to kind of pay attention to what's happening politically.
Mm-hmm. Okay, to both of you, each of you, you know, every person is different, and your impressions of what you see are different also. Which is the most impressive vista that you have seen in South America? You know, the one that you say, the trip in South America, boom, this image comes up to your mind. Each of you, tell us, what was that?
Oh, no doubt in my mind, the Perito Moreno Glacier. And I actually, it may be in Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth. I haven't seen the movie yet. But when that glacier started falling apart and big, huge pieces of ice were falling off there, it has to be the most stunning thing I have ever seen.
Tim?
Well, there's so many. The Great Wall of China, Machu Picchu, or we're talking about South America. Machu Picchu in South America. There is this road. I mean, the special thing about traveling by bike is it's the places in between. And there is this road going over a high Andean pass after Huayanca. And just on some road, that road, we don't even know the name of it. It was just a road on our map that we thought we'd give a try. And it took us up to 4,600 meters or something. And just every direction of every view of that, with the snow-capped mountains and the high sheep herders living up there, and just a whole different way of life, that sticks in my mind. But just many, many things. They could be jungles, volcanoes with smoke bellowing out of them. I can go on and on.
Okay, talking about people. Okay, in what South American country you saw the most prominent contrast among its population?
No doubt Bolivia.
I agree, Bolivia.
That's of any country we've been in since as well. I've never seen people so poor, and then on the other hand, people so rich, to where we were in the grocery store and realized that everybody else in there was a maid shopping for someone else.
Let me clarify that. But most places you travel in the developing world, you can come away saying, wow, the contrast between rich and poor is big. And that's true. But in Bolivia, you either drive a Ferrari or you wish you had a bicycle. And what Cindy's referring to, the grocery store, most people don't buy things in a grocery store. But we were looking for things like peanut butter and some things that we could carry on the bike instead of live chickens. And in this grocery store, it was all people in maid outfits because they were shopping for the rich people that they worked for. So that was the biggest contrast in economic level. And it also, Bolivia had many different indigenous groups. So I think that was the most.
Okay. Okay, now let's move to the Asian leg of your tour. Okay. How was it when you got into countries where they didn't speak either English or Spanish? You know, it's a complete change of what you've been used to for this couple of years. How did you manage to communicate with the locals?
Well, it was difficult because, we've told you before, after 2 years in Latin America, we've become pretty intermediate speakers of Spanish, and we can carry on an interview and speak in Spanish quite well. So when we went to Asia, and first country we went to was Thailand, we would meet people who didn't understand English, and then we would switch to Spanish just out of habit, trying to speak to them in Spanish, and that didn't go anywhere. It was very frustrating. You can't even read the signs. They use a different script. And, you know, you start hunting around for the English or someone who speaks English. But eventually we just learned to use a dictionary and sign language.
A phrase book.
Uh-huh.
That was frustrating, but I learned really early on to learn how to count in each country and say it's too expensive and try to bargain. I mean, that's the first thing I learned was numbers and bargaining.
Yeah, I have to keep in mind that all the countries we went to for the first 2 years was all Spanish. Different accents, a few different words, but all Spanish. When we went to Asia, the Thai speak Thai, of course, and they write in Thai script. And then you cross the border to Cambodia, and it's a completely different language with a completely different script. And as soon as you start catching on to the basics there, then we went over to Vietnam with another completely different language. And so we had to start all over again. And as soon as we had 3 months in Vietnam and caught up a little bit, we went to China, which is a completely different language and script and world altogether.
Yeah, so it was like starting to, I'm getting the hang of this. Oh, new one.
Well, we always start by learning the numbers. how to ask for things like, how much is that? Oh, that's too expensive. And then you know the numbers, because bargaining is a way of life, so you can't just take the first price. They'll lose respect for you. Mm-hmm. And where is the bathroom? And you have to be able to read men and women and things like this. Just where's a hotel? How much is the hotel? Where's a restaurant? You got to know a few things on the menu that you're willing to eat and things like this.
Okay. You know, what about food? What about food? You know, in Latin America, I think that you saw there were many different kind of food, but when you start seeing each different country, there were some things that were common to. But in Asia, it's a different story, right?
Yeah, the food's real different. Depending on where we're at, the food in China actually was quite good on a day-to-day basis, as long as we ordered vegetables and didn't really ask for much meat, because they don't cut meat up nicely. They just throw it in there with bones, and we just didn't really like that too much. But they cooked their vegetables real well, and you could point and just say together, and then they'd make you something that was edible.
It is tough, because you don't often know what they're cooking, and there's some things you definitely may not want, like in northern Vietnam and southern China, they eat dog. So you learn these words for things you don't want. But most of the time, Cindy would go back with the lady who ran the kitchen, or the man, and would go back and point in pots. And she would point in this pot and that pot and order that way. And we did that more often than not in Asia.
Mm. Okay. Okay, moving to another topic. Okay, you have seen a lot of animal life as well as plant life in your travels. How does each experience in all the countries you have visited compare?
Yeah, how do they compare? I'd have to say Australia has the most unique animals I've ever seen. It's quite a delight here.
And the most abundant.
And the most abundant, yeah. And actually, you can't even drive at night. I never knew that you really shouldn't drive at night because there's animals but the animals here are very unique, like the kangaroo and the Tasmanian devils.
Go ahead.
We saw wildlife everywhere we went, but the more densely populated the area, like Asia, you'll see a lot less. You'll see some birds and things, but no big mammals. And in Latin America, you know, the climate's quite dry and harsh in places, and so there's not a lot there. You can see some llamas and things like this. But when we got to Australia has wonderful wildlife, and it's real abundant. The variety of birds and kangaroos and Tasmanian devils and duck-billed platypus, all these animals you hear about as a children are abundant and really fun to watch here.
Yeah, I saw your videos on your website, and I was laughing out loud when I saw the Tasmanian devil. You know? I think that they are really cute animals, don't you think?
Yeah. They're kind of having problems in Tasmania because they have, they're disappearing from the wild because they're sick.
Oh, is that so?
But they are very cute, and they're very rowdy little things, and they like to bite each other, and they like to play, and they're very fun to watch.
Okay, I think it was in Thailand where you came across a lot of monkeys. Is that correct?
Yes, we came across, I think he stole, all the videos are on our site. We can give the address later. But yes, in Thailand, in different places, and we're not Buddhist, and we're not familiar with Buddhism that well, but in different places, the monkey was somewhat worshipped. So they fed them, and they multiplied, and they were everywhere, and they kind of expected food. And Cindy doesn't particularly like monkeys, so I always filmed her riding through them.
Monkeys can be aggressive, and I don't like that part. When people feed them, then they expect, they look at you and say, you're going to feed me, and then I've even had them try to scare me to make me drop something. And so monkeys, I like to look at them, but I don't like it when they get aggressive in their little packs.
Yeah, I think it is sometimes like some people, you know, that they get... they get used to you know, here in the stoplights, you know, sometimes you get this. It's less common than 10 years ago, But 10 or 15 years ago, you know, there were many people asking for money on the stoplights, and you know they actually expected that you give them something. So if you don't give anything, they say, "Whoa, what happened? Did I do something wrong?" Like, so it was not. I laugh now, but it was not, at the moment. It was not something too comfortable to live with. But thanks God, it is no longer an issue. But when you mentioned that about the monkeys, you know, like they expect that you give them something and you don't give, so they get aggressive. You know, I think sometimes that people sometimes don't behave like people. Do you agree with me?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, now we started talking about Australia. You know, in general, how have been your Down Under experience so far?
Well, Australia is a wonderful country to travel. They speak English, of course, which is a huge advantage. So we were so eager to get somewhere we could ask people directions. You know, 2 years in Asia, just being like in this little bubble and only really being able to talk to one another, we got here, we can talk to everybody. And that's been great. And then the cycling's really nice. There's not a lot of traffic on the roads. The roads are in good condition. The camping is beautiful. The water's clean. It's not polluted. It's been real different.
I have to say that the Australians have been incredibly hospitable. Just real easy going, easy to talk to. We've been invited into a lot of people's homes and just real generous, hospitable people.
Mm. That's good. You know, have you met many other bike travelers in your travels?
On and off. It depends on the country, but we have. Through 5 years of travel, we have. But there's been times we've gone 6 months without seeing one.
Mm. Okay. Now let's move on in other topic. You know, some people ask me, you know, about the equipment. You know, I like more the experience of traveling, but some people like the technical aspects of some technical aspects. I'm not going to get too much into technical details because you have plenty of information on your website about equipment and stuff. But just for the sake that of people, I'm going to ask you some questions about your equipment. One thing that is comes to my mind is, how you keep your electronic equipment safe and dry while on the road?
Well, I've done different things through the years, and all of them have worked and all of them have failed. The moment I use a waterproof pannier and I keep the computer and we have a camera and I have even a little stereo I have on the bike with an MP3 player, I keep everything in a waterproof pannier, and then in the waterproof pannier, I tend to keep it in like a dry bag, or the computer's in a neoprene cover, and I just pack it and double pack it and pad it, and it's a hard life for electronics to live on a bike. We fare better than the electronics.
Okay. How do you recharge batteries on the long stretches with no access to power lines? You just don't use your equipment? Because I know that you keep working on your page and all this stuff on your tent, but at the times that you go long stretches with nothing for miles, what do you do to keep your batteries? Do you have some way of recharging them that we don't know of, or you just don't use it until you get to some kind of civilization?
Well, when I first left, I thought I would charge things with a solar panel. This was a big concern of mine about how to keep the batteries going. But the solar panel didn't put out enough electricity. It couldn't keep up with the demands. And so I traded the solar panel in on bigger batteries and an extension cord. So it's not that I charge the batteries that often. It's that I have big batteries, and when I charge them, they last a long time. And every country, you know, you can have different currents and different plugs and all this, a whole mess of things to sort out and understand for plug adapters and different currents. But once you figure it out and you know how much of it you use, like I know how long my camera batteries will last and how long the computer batteries will last, then you just buy big enough batteries to meet that demand. And this is my system, and then I just charge those batteries every chance I get. And we pretty much use the computer anytime we want and for hours every day if we choose. And there are times and days we don't pull it out at all.
Okay. Now, regarding your bikes, and I want each of you to give your personal experience answer to this question. I know that you are now riding on Koga Miata bikes. How did they responded after all these miles on the road? How long have you owned them?
The Kogas we've had since we flew to Bangkok, so over 2 years ago. And like any bike, we wear out a drivetrain about once a year. About once a year, I get three chain rings, a cassette, a chain, and maybe some brake pads. By chains, I would prefer to get four chains a year, but that just isn't possible financially. So I get at least a chain every 6 months or a chain for each bike. Cindy?
I've had, it's held up pretty good. I've had to replace, you know, the grips on the bar. I just recently replaced them, but it's been a pretty solid bike, comfortable. That's really what's important is comfort.
If you start out with a good quality bike and then you replace it with good quality parts as you go, to me, that's what works. I don't wait till something breaks before I replace it. I tend to wait till it starts looking old or starts looking like it could break, because I want to choose when I replace it, not let the bike choose, because we've made that mistake in the past.
Yeah, you know, the first bikes that you use for your trip from Mexico to Panama, were they comfortable, or you had some concerns on that bike?
My bike was custom made, and it was very comfortable. The frame flexed a bit much for my taste, but Cindy...
Yeah, I wasn't comfortable on my bike. I just kind of didn't quite fit on it comfortably. And with the bike I have now, I fit nice. I'm comfortable when I get on, so I'm much happier now.
That's good. Okay. Jimmy Conrad is a fan of your show, and he's from Bayamón. Here in Puerto Rico, and he has two questions, one technical and one personal. The first question is, do you miss your relatives while on the road?
Oh, yes, that's been probably one of the hardest things to get used to. And right now, my sister and my nephew are going to come out in May. And Tim's sister and whole family, they're all actually coming out together. So we've had family come and visit. So they're coming out here to Australia, and then we'll work our way back to the States and visit when we get there.
We have to visit about every 3 or 4 years, and my mother gets quite angry. That's not really true. My mom doesn't get angry. Don't get mad, Mom. But it isn't. It isn't right to your family just to take off forever. So we do try to come home from time to time. We came home between South America and Asia, and we published my first book. And we're publishing the second book on the road. And after Australia, and then we're going to go to New Zealand, I think we're going to go to Alaska. Well, we're planning on going to Alaska and visiting Cindy's twin sister. And then working our way down through Canada and going on a big tour, visiting all of our families, before we go off to the Middle East and Africa.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The other question that Mr. Conrad has is on the technical side. It might seem like a simple question, but here it is. What saddle do each of you use on your bikes? The stock one, or you change for something more comfortable?
Well, I used the stock one that came with the bike, a Brooks leather touring saddle. Cindy's very particular about her saddles. I'll let her speak.
Yeah, when I first started riding a bike, you can ask Tim, I bought like 10 different types of saddles. And finally, I came upon Terry saddles, which are women-specific design saddles. And I won't ride anything else because I don't have problems with saddle sores. I can ride for hours. You want a saddle that you don't even think about. And I don't even think about that saddle anymore.
But there's quite a lengthy discussion of saddles on the webpage under the equipment section that goes through the entire history and experience, because the saddle is the, people think it's going to be their legs or their hands. It winds up being your rear end that makes cycling hard, especially if you haven't cycled much and you take off on tour. So the saddle is a very important piece of equipment to keep you on the road. And without the saddle you're happy with, you're going to wind up going home or have a miserable trip or something.
Yeah, you know, this reminds me in here, you know, when I got my bike, you know, it had this kind of a racing type of saddle. And when I did like a 40-mile trip, you know, I could not move my legs because the pain was so excruciating. And people said, no, just keep this saddle. You know, this is the one you should keep. This is the one you should keep. So for some time, I listened to people. Then I went to a store and saw this big, wide seat. I took it in my hands and forget it. So I just put it. So many people criticized me. Oh, this big. Oh, this weighs too much, blah, blah. Now I'm comfortable. I can go like 50, 75 miles. Let's go another.
Well, a comfortable saddle is very important, as we all know.
You know, yeah, I am not light. You know, I am like 220 pounds now. I am 6'5", so I need a good saddle. I need a good saddle for me. Okay, so thank you both of you for being here for our audience. Really pleased that you had the time, found the time to share some of your experience, because you know, 5 years on the road is a lot of time, a lot of experience. Impossible to condense it in almost 1 hour that we have been talking. It's like around 47 minutes right now. We have been talking. It's impossible to summarize. But at least we got a glimpse. Do you have some ending comments for people about getting into this into bike touring or into doing like you did and you know getting into living on the road? Do you have some closing comments for people?
Well, I'll get to that question in a moment. But we want to thank you for having us and for playing the first chapter of the audiobook. That was wonderful. Because we want to tell people the background, and we want to have people know how we got here to encourage them or inspire them to do the same thing. To show our appreciation, we'd like to mail you a copy of the printed book. So if you could send that to us in email as a gift to show our appreciation.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you very much. I appreciate, really appreciate it.
Really appreciate it. Now, to answer your question, which tied into that first chapter of our audiobook, don't give in to fear. When you're talking about going on a trip somewhere, people will tell you why you can't go, or you shouldn't go there because it's dangerous, or the people will hit you in a car, or you'll get robbed, or things like this. You need to pay attention to some of that, but most people are just afraid of things, and you need to let go of that and find out for yourself that fear will be the biggest inhibitor of your trip. And as soon as you start paying attention and relying on your own skills and confidence, you'll see a lot more of the world. And if you listen to others, especially if they've never been there, you'll wind up never leaving your home.
I just kind of want to add a couple things. Tim and I saved money for a long time for this before we left, and we made a budget, and I kind of laughed at Tim when he first presented the budget to me. I was like, I can't survive on that. And it turns out we can, and in some places easier than others. But in the big, long-term, big picture, the budget really has kept us on the road. So if you can kind of get into a rhythm with your budget and live within it, then anything's possible.
Yeah, what we do with the budgets, we withdraw a certain amount of money every week, and we put that much money in the wallet, and that's it. And if we run out, we just have to do without and find a way to live on it until the next week starts. Now, in some countries, you don't get an ATM machine every week, so you put cash aside and pull some of that out in the wallet every week.
Okay. So thank you very much. Thank you very much, and thank you for the book. You know, I really appreciate it. I like to read a lot. You know, I need to get some new glasses. You know, I've been losing a bit of eyesight in the past months. I've been concerned about that because I need my eyes for the work I do. But I think this is part of age.
We know you listen to the 7.5-hour audiobook, and I thought, well, maybe you'd like a printed book to look through, and it has over 150 pictures, and maybe you'll see a different side of it. Things seem different in print than they do in audio, and even though it's the same book, you may get a different experience from it.
Yeah, and I really appreciate that. So, Tim and Cindy, again, thanks. I don't find enough ways to thank you for being here and sharing your experience with the people. And you know that you are now part of the Bike Tourist Podcast family, and we always feel free to give us updates and or anything you want to communicate about your trip. You just feel that the Bike Tourist Podcast is there for you. And we are with you in your travels, and I'm sure many people in the audience is now following up in your trips. So thank you very much again, and say goodbye to the audience. On my part, thank you very much.
Thank you, Gabriel. Mi casa es su casa. My house is your house. And until we hear from each other again.
Thank you, Gabriel. Nice talking to you.
Okay, thank you. But before we go, tell us about your website, because you have plenty of information over there. Tell the people about your website and what you have over there.
Well, the website we've been building for the last 5 years, it's at www.downtheroad.org. We tried to get .com, but it was taken, so we're .org. And we figure because we're married, that's an organization. On the website's over 10,000 photos we've taken during the last few years, and Cindy has kept a daily journal, or now called a blog, for the past 5 years. And the newest thing is we have little videos I've been learning how to make, and they're on the site as well. And we'd love to hear from anybody, and our email's on the site.
Okay, so there you have it, the audience, the website. downtheroad.org, go there, experience all the information they have, not just about the trip, but other topics, and there are plenty of experiences, and if you need to communicate with them, the links and the emails are over there. There are plenty of ways to communicate with Tim and Cindy, and again, we are glad to have them here. So we say goodbye now. This has been a special presentation by the Bike Tourist Podcast. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.